Hello, and welcome to episode 84 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Adrian Curry, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Sociology, Philosophy, and Anthropology at Exeter University. Adrian is interested in scientific method. How do scientists generate knowledge, and why does it work? He doesn't think there's a particularly interesting general answer to this question. After all, scientists are a motley opportunist bunch. They utilize a wide variety of methods and techniques in order to exploit varying lines of evidence toward a variety of different aims. Much of the philosophical action is local. This doesn't mean that us philosophers of science can't say anything general about knowledge, knowledge generation, or the world. Rather, it means that such claims are best constructed in a piecemeal fashion. Much of his research focuses on the historical sciences, paleontology, archaeology, geology, and so forth. He argues that both philosophers and methodologically reflective scientists have underestimated the epistemic resources available for uncovering the deep past, and have missed the power of such sciences. Instead, he provides an expansive account of those resources. We should be optimists about our capacity to uncover much about the deep past. In addition, Adrian is one of the founders of and a regular contributor to Extinct, a blog covering the intersection between philosophy and paleontology. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Adrian. All right, we're back. Dr. Adrian Curry, welcome again to the Sci-Fi Podcast. Good to have you. Good to have you and welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah, great, great. So as we were trying to get to some sound things going, we were discussing, so figuring out how this term's working. You're currently teaching at the University of Exeter, is that right?
Yeah, so it's a little southwest of Britain, which is a beautiful place to be, and it's nice to sort of, as I was saying, nice to be back on the ground again after the madness of going around traveling in summer.
Right, right. So, yeah. So, how's your time been there? Or perhaps tell me a little bit about the program there. What are things like in the philosophy of science at Exeter?
Well, so Exeter is a really interesting place to be doing the philosophy of science because, particularly the philosophy of the life sciences. So, in addition to the sort of philosophy program within the sort of big department of various disciplines, there's a center called Agenis, which is the center for the philosophy and sociology of the life sciences. And so it's a kind of pretty unique environment where you have like a very strong cluster of philosophers, but also a very strong cluster of people doing science and technology studies, anthropology of science, sociology of science. And so you're kind of very much in a kind of really, I guess you'd call it interdisciplinary kind of context. We're sort of very much in the business of sort of smudging those boundaries. And so it's really fun being somewhere where, as it were, I'm not just talking to philosophers about science. I'm speaking to this like broad array of people about science.
Very nice. And you mentioned there's this, is it a center of some kind or something that's kind of connected that where it's a little bit more interdisciplinary?
Yeah. One way of thinking about it is it's a, everyone in Agenis is kind of connected to various departments throughout the university. But it's a sort of extremely active sort of research center. So think of it as kind of, it has its own physical location. We have a visitor program. We have talks and reading groups. So it kind of has the research activity of an extremely thriving department, except it's not a department.
Right. A program, a center, something that offers, fellowships, things like that to get people, warm bodies there. That's the idea.
Yeah. I mean, especially at the moment, sort of as we're all, say post-COVID, but kind of pseudo post-COVID starting to try and remember how to interact with one another again and things like that.
How did your approach to like research, teaching, things like that, how has that been over the past little while? I mean, has that, have you found new ways of doing things? Have there been, some growths in some areas?
Certainly sort of, I think one thing
I mean, very early on in the pandemic, something that was really helpful to me in a sense was realizing that more or less the world was ending. So I didn't need to worry so much about the kind of obligations that I'd set up. And I sort of was like, it gave me free rein to just be like, hey, I'm just going to write a bunch of papers that I've always wanted to write. And so early on, I just was able to be like incredibly selfish in my research. And that was kind of great. I mean, obviously then things went on for far too long. but so there was a sense in which for me, like I'd been really driving myself too hard and was traveling far too much and had too many things up in the air simultaneously such that I wasn't able to do anything particularly well, right? I was very stretched thin. And there's a sense in which having everything stop for sort of 3 months really helped me sort of get a bit of perspective on how I should organize my life as a sort of researching academic and how to sort of have space a bit more was kind of crucial for me, I think.
Fantastic. Well, we'll get into talking about some of those papers you wrote or other things that you've been doing. I'm excited to hear. But yeah, before we do, let's take a step back to figure out how you got into philosophy of science, how you got into philosophy of the life sciences in particular, and how you developed this focus in things we might not hear so much in philosophy of science, like philosophy of focusing in with anthropology and paleobiology, things like that. So tell us, Adrian, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Christchurch, which is the sort of second biggest or equal second biggest sort of city in New Zealand, in the sort of South Island. I grew up down there.
what was life like down there? What is it known for? What is it? You know, what's the setting for us?
Well, I mean, New Zealand's, you know, not that sort of culturally different to other sort of colonial Anglophone countries. Some things that kind of are more particular to, New Zealand culture. There's a tendency towards kind of like egalitarianism and that kind of thing. My parents are both sort of very sort of committed sort of, egalitarian people on a sort of political perspective. So I sort of grew up in a very sort of a religious middle class kind of context. And that sort of fitted in with New Zealand quite well. When you're growing up in New Zealand, you tend to have sort of slightly more sort of understanding of sort of relationships with, indigenous people than you might do in other places. If you get culture shock moving between, say, New Zealand, Australia, and the States, you need to, go to more places. Let's put it that way.
Fair enough. I understand. Okay. What did you find yourself up to growing up? What kinds of interests did you have? Was philosophy something of immediate interest, or were there other things going on?
It definitely wasn't. So I was very much very, very, like, not really into science in any meaningful way, but was, very into kind of poetry and music and these kinds of things. So when I was sort of 15, 16 onwards, was very much interested in, I suppose you might call it the arts, in a very sort of idiosyncratic kind of way. So when I went to university, the original thing I studied was, English and composition and music composition.
Oh, wonderful.
And, I more or less took philosophy as a sort of option, in the first year of undergraduate and, kind of took it as, my perception of what philosophy would be like was very different to what philosophy was in fact like, where of course I imagined it to be something, you might like smoke a joint and sit around and sort of say, hey man, kind of thing. And
undergraduate philosophy, what that looks like, sure.
Yeah, and managed to very, very much like just fail my first exam outright, which was really shocking because everything else I'd done in sort of in like things like English, I found that I was a good writer, so I could just say some stuff and it would be all right. And philosophy managed to, it was one of those few times in my life where I failed at something in just the right way. It's made me go, wait. usually when you fail something, you're like, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. Where somehow I managed, this was the perfect fail.
You leaned into it.
That kind of made me go, oh, there's more to it than this. And so that kind of led me to sort of do sort of more and more philosophy. But I definitely did not, come into doing, my undergraduate degree with any sense of wanting to be a philosopher. I guess, for a bit there, I wanted to be a rock star. For a bit there, I was like a performance poet. I think suffice to say, I think my parents were pretty delighted when it turned out that I was interested in something that kind of, it's funny to say given the academic job market, but the other options I was considering were even more ridiculous.
Right. The probability of, well, so in terms of music, what kind of, so imagine doing some, did you have a music group, a band, were you a solo artist?
I played in bands a lot when I was, think like late teens, early 20s. I'm not actually very good at music, is the kind of ironic thing. But, I played in quite sort of different bands. So I probably the weirdest thing I did was for a while I had a sort of found percussion kit. So that was like a 44-gallon drum and with a spade sort of taped to it and this big like iron cage thing that I would use as,
oh, wow.
Sort of percussion in like – I was in this progressive industrial goth. I don't know.
Yeah,
like
it was
a good time. So I sort of played in a bunch of these sort of different kinds of bands, and kind of did sort of performance poetry and, was involved in these sort of sorts of things. And then, so one way of describing my sort of misspent youth is I kind of transitioned from that, to working for a bank.
As you do. It's complete opposite.
And I think there's a sense in which one thing that's, I think, ultimately kind of attractive about being an academic was it's sort of nice there in between those two things in a strange way. What I found with, what I learned from, so for, quite a few years, actually, I was sort of working both in kind of customer service, but also ultimately kind of home lending, like that sort of stuff. So sales. And found that it was something that I was extremely good at, but I hated. And it took me a really long time to realize that just because you're good at something doesn't mean you should do it.
Right. That's interesting, though. No, I mean, I have family that works in banking in different ways. And there's always, not always that path, but it is a very like, there's good career prospects. But so that's interesting to hear that. So you're very good at, did not like it.
I suppose one way of thinking about it was just, at first what was really nice, like having kind of tried to go this kind of more sort of anti-establishment punk kind of route in my life, sort of going, I feel like I'm like a real member of society. And there was something really nice about that, because I often felt really, just uncomfortable with outsider I felt. And it was very nice at first to be kind of, feel like you were a functioning, contributing member of society. But then it was just so horrifically alienating to sort of do that kind of work. And of course, there's absolutely nothing wrong with providing people with mortgages. It's not like I was working in a, I was helping people who,
Can help now, I'm sure they'd be very grateful. Like getting some lower interest rates, that would be nice.
Yeah. it's not like most of the people I was selling to were sort of giant, like, investment slumlords. They were families buying houses, right? Sure. And that's sort of important. But the way the whole thing was structured, all of that made me feel just deeply unhappy. And I remember I sort of got to quit around about like when I was starting my sort of master's thesis, and like just the feeling of never having to go back there was kind of the most sort of freeing. And even though like my income just went thunk, it was such a feeling. And I guess one part of it is like, for me at least, knowing what you're running away from is really helpful.
Keeping that in your purview of real, it makes you quite grateful once you get back. Like, I don't know. I had a similar experience where I went and worked in marketing and was like, I don't know. It did feel good to be a part of something I think there's some other academics that were, there's this sense where there is a formal work style to it, but it's, yeah, you can be feeling very grateful for what you're not doing, per se.
Yeah. So the sort of lifestyle aspects of sort of being an academic and like the capacity to, at least if you try really hard, feel that you have some ownership over what you're doing.
Yes.
And of course, all the stuff about, you know, a little bit of travel and a little bit of having control of your
schedule
and things is pretty great.
Great. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So, but so you mentioned you had studied English or literature or English composition or music composition in English. And so at the time you were still, I see here, so you were still in, you were in New Zealand. And
yeah. So this was, I studied in Wellington. So basically I had kind of felt like I'd been in Christchurch, you know, my entire life and had spent a couple of years sort of living out of home, kind of playing in bands and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, I need to get out of here. And so kind of, you know, and also there's that very standard kind of middle class thing of there's that time where you go to university. So I remember it was quite, you know, that I didn't go directly to university from high school. I remember there being some like tension about me doing that because it, you know, it wasn't the normal thing.
Sure.
But still I sort of inevitably went off to do my undergraduate degree. Originally did English and music composition. English was a sort of, at the time, was a fairly standard kind of English literature degree, right? So we read Mallory and all that sort of stuff, Chaucer, etc. And then the music composition degree was, I don't know if so far as I can tell, like music degrees are more or less the same at universities. They're pretty same the world over. You've got the people who do performance, who are all extremely talented people who are sort of aiming to sort of be in orchestras and things. Right. And then you have the composition kids, who are just this bunch of like weirdos.
Oh, I didn't know this. I didn't know the breakup.
Yeah, the composition students are always just sort of strange. And that was really fun. We sort of would do things like have classes where, you know, we would listen to a piece and try and there's like these weird sort of, you know, modern classical pieces and be like, what were the instruments in this? And try
like, what are that sounds super interesting.
A lot of digital music stuff. So a lot of sort of listening to sort of what more or less appears to be white noise and thinking about how they made it. And it was a good time.
Oh, that sounds
I was also very bad at it.
It sounds like a lot of fun. And the idea of deconstructing music like that sounds, like a very enjoyable. I think it would be a very informative class regardless. But in terms of further studying, and so was there a sense where, so I've known, I guess I've spent more time around, I guess, more of the performance arts folks with that kind of track. But then folks who've gone to like recording academies, generally that's the track in the U.S. is you go to some sort of like a recording school and you get, you're trying to get into the music production. Like your style of music composition is more like music production. So you're going to become maybe not be a producer per se, but you are, I don't know, you might go for like EDM music or something to go produce in that particular way.
This was much more geared in sort of modern classical music.
I could imagine.
So this was
like, in a music school.
So we, you know, and it was, but it was very like, you know, me and a friend for one of our assignments wrote a piece called Dissection for Guitar that was a graphical score and just perform with an acoustic guitar, play with a knife and a spoon. And it's all very sort of very artsy, but
Fun. And mixed and then obviously with English, so there was a little mixture of poetry and maybe spoken word performance or
performance. It was much more sort of text analysis and kind of, I mean, I felt at the time like it was kind of making stuff up. I mean, I think these days, English departments by and large are now incredibly rich. So, rich sort of in terms of the things they do, right? Okay. So if someone says they're an English professor, that could mean almost anything in terms of they might be doing digital humanities. They might be doing traditional textual analysis. They might be just be doing history of science, right? There's a bunch of people in English here at Exeter who are kind of doing history of science, right? Which is good. I think it's great that English has become such a varied kind of discipline to sort of be part of people to work in. But at least at the sort of first year, second year undergraduate level where I studied it, it felt kind of traditional and I didn't take to it very well. I learned some stuff and it was fun, but
but then I guess the thought of, and then in terms of going into a career with like Yeah. So in terms of like working in composition, it would be something where you could, I imagine, teach in it as well as maybe go on to compose. It's just like any arts career. It can be pretty challenging to monetize it. Yeah.
I definitely had no idea at the time. Like this is
sure. What, you just want to do what I'm you want to.
This is like 12 years ago. I had no idea.
Right. You're not like you didn't have this like I mean, some people do, but a lot of times, when you're younger, you might have this more. This feels good. This is stimulating. This just sounds like something I could at least it's be worthwhile to learn right now. So totally understand.
Well, I think I'm also a very sort of classic case of coming from a certain level of privilege where I didn't feel the pressure to try and go right. What's my career going to be? How am I going to sort of make money? I think there's a lot of entitlement in how I was, why I was able to sort of have that kind of attitude.
Sure. You kind of realize after the fact, or maybe during, but sometimes later, right. Yeah.
I definitely wasn't conscious of that stuff at the time.
Usually you're not. Okay. So then what brought you, was there like a turn in terms of then doing the MA in philosophy? How did that, how did that come to be?
Yeah, so roughly, part of it was sort of slowly realizing that actually I did kind of have time and philosophy was the thing I could do. So I very much just kind of fell in love with it. Like I sort of, those first few philosophy classes really sort of grabbed me. There was something about, I think, the combination of this kind of really creative, imaginative sort of work, which is also at the same time extremely careful and rigorous. It's an extremely strange way to work. I just sort of fell in love with thinking in those kind of abstract spaces and those ways. The reason that I sort of found myself doing the philosophy of science, honestly, I think is massively contingent on where I was. So at least at the time, the philosophy department at Wellington was, kind of analytic naturalist philosophy of science, by and large. And so heavily influenced by kind of East Coast metaphysics as well. So there was a lot of sort of the sort of stuff I was doing was very sort of read some David Lewis and also read some of this other stuff. And that kind of led me to kind of start sort of thinking something like, well, it seems like science is a good way of knowing about the world. If I want to know about the world, I guess I should do some science. But also, honestly, like the person who I was sort of most interested in working with at Wellington was Kim Sterelny, who, one way of putting it was that the reason I ended up working on the philosophy of biology was because the person who I liked the stuff of the most in the department was the philosopher of biology. And so I fell into that. So I don't think there's any special reason about me that led me to work in those areas. It was rather that those were the sort of funnels in that sort of program. And, it's remarkable how much the kinds of things that you learn in the context of your undergraduate degree kind of just shape the way you see philosophy. And I feel like I've spent the last sort of since then kind of just learning all these ways in which I'm biased and wrong about the way that philosophy works. So anytime you go to a different department, there's just this different set of things that they think are going issues. And you realize how kind of cloistered and biased your particular conception of philosophy is.
So that's a good reason, I guess, to advocate for, that there is sort of a value of folks who have gone and studied, not like, let's say, all the same university, outside of maybe certain universities, right? But then thought is to find different settings to work with others. And
I mean, I do think that this is sort of perhaps jumping ahead to some other sort of topics, but maybe something to, I do think that something that's difficult for people who are starting to do philosophy is sort of, if you're trying to work out what to do your PhD on, it's often incredibly difficult to get a sense because you're supposed to sort of have a research project. But if you've just done an undergraduate philosophy degree, for instance, you're really in no position to have a good sense of what the space of possibility is. So one reason to, I don't like the American system usually, but one thing that I do like about it is those 2 years of coursework kind of at least give you a space to sort of get more of a sense of what you might do your PhD on.
Right.
And so I think that one way in which I was quite lucky, I think, was that, you know, so the kind of research that Kim was doing and other people in that area, although it was, of course, you know, philosophy of biology, it was very open-ended in terms of what sorts of things you might want to do. And so I sort of felt more free to sort of explore, I guess.
Great, great. Well, I'm happy to hear that you had a, sounds like a good time. A fulfilling time at Wellington. And so this led you to go about applying and doing a PhD in Australia at Australian National University. Is that right?
Yeah.
Great, great. How was that? How was going on? Obviously, I've known very well about ANU. I've never visited, but you know, I've just heard it's a great place to study. What was it like there?
Really intense.
very
intense. So, you know, it was one of those places where being present and being engaged in research generally was highly valued, and right. things were really sort of structured around it. So, you know, it was more or less expected that you would be going to talks. It was very, very expected that at the talks you would have things to say. You know, there are some things about the sort of culture at ANU which, you know, at the time that I kind of, you know, that now are a bit more worrying. There was a bit of that kind of aggressive kind of approach to doing stuff. You wanted to be, you know, all the graduate students wanted to be the one who's got the knockdown sort of question, all that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, I think maybe a lot of sort of philosophical communities who have sort of spent the last decade or so learning that it turns out you can be really, really rigorous and like, you know, that without being aggressive. So I think what I learned that was incredible, there was this, you know, capacity to really engage with the philosophical ideas in real time in those sorts of contexts. And the thing I had to unlearn later was how to do it in a way which is more constructive and less just stress testing.
Right, right. Well, that's good. And so that some of the things that you're alluding to, certainly we've heard been written about in, metadisciplinary posts or writings reflecting on best practices, and it's interesting, yeah, because the thought is speaking in terms of how might your undergrad or what influenced the way in which you view philosophy, it very much so the culture of your graduate study could certainly influence how you expect things to happen, what you expect to do, and then what you carry on to continue to supervise in your current program, which is more than likely not going to be at the same institution.
Really tricky. Like, so I found going to other places quite hard because you kind of have this expectation about how sort of research communities are going to work.
Right.
And if you've been at one that's that sort of focused and intense, it takes a while to sort of jig yourself. You know, like I don't have that problem at Exeter because there's a lot going on, but
right.
it is kind of a challenging experience as you sort of spend 4 or 5 years learning how to not just do philosophy, but sort of be in philosophical contexts, and then yep. learning that actually those contexts are really diverse and you have to learn to be flexible.
Great. Well, so tell us a little bit about your dissertation project, how it came to be, what you ended up claiming, how did it get on?
So the PhD went through a bit of a journey, which is, I think, good. So I started out, the PhD was on reductionism. So and it was reductionism in like kind of across things. So I was thinking about, well, what's going on in reductionism in the philosophy of mind and in the philosophy of science and in sort of metaphysics? Are there kind of continuities between these things? You know, this sounds like a kind of a standard intro, here's my research project, where it's like, well, that's way too broad. So I thought about that for a while and read a whole bunch of the reductionism stuff and sort of found that a lot of it sort of bottomed out on either some weird question that maybe physics might answer in a bazillion years, but probably won't, or something about your philosophical commitments, right? So you ended up being like, well, I don't think I can argue about whether you think this or this, but which one of these you take is going to decide what view you ultimately take on this form of explanatory or metaphysical reduction or whatever. And so I was sort of finding that hard. But I had this sort of thought at some point where I was like, well, most of the time when we're thinking about reduction, at least in sort of metaphysical and explanatory context, it's very sort of time slicey. It's very, if you want, kind of vertical. You know, you're thinking about big things being made of little things and mereology and these kinds of stuff. And I sort of thought, well, what does it look like? What does reductionism look like in geology, right? So what happens when you've got sort of, you know, knowledge producing practice that is stretched out across time, as opposed to, you know, stretched across scale, mereological scales, right? And so I thought, that's a weird sort of idea. And there was a few papers that I started sort of looking at, but then I sort of found myself just reading some paleontology. So I started reading how did sauropod dinosaurs get so big? Was sort of this research question that I sort of started looking at. And so there was this middle bit of the thesis where I was thinking about reductionism in the context of paleontology, and then the reductionism just left. So it was like first stage was just reduction, second stage was reduction in dinosaurs, then it was just dinosaurs. And what kind of happened was, as soon as I started reading, like digging into those debates in paleontology and in sort of a little bit of paleoclimatology and things like that, what they were doing was just so fascinating and so different to what you would expect if you read standard philosophy of science, that I just sort of realized that there's so much going on in these sciences that we're just paying no attention to. And so it was kind of money for jam in a certain sense. It was like, I can just read this and kind of philosophy happens because there's just so many interesting aspects, like the way they're using. Sorry, my cat is just climbing on the computer, which could cause disasters.
Of course. Oh, no. Oh, hello.
And so, I mean, you know, of course it is also quite hard, but those were just so rich and fascinating.
The idea is just kind of like when you find those debates, it's, yeah, you just get very, you're not having to pull, well, reductionism is obviously very difficult, but it's, I don't know. Yeah. Coming at it from a different way where you're jumping into these other debates, it can be so rich. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and one way of thinking about it is, you know, like there is, so, and I think a lot of this is your own, I think different people work in different sorts of ways. And some people are very, very good at going into highly worked out spaces and figuring out cool stuff to do within those spaces. Right. Whereas other people are better at going into areas that are kind of not that explored and trying to sort of map stuff out. And I tend to work much more in that sort of latter sense. That's just kind of more what I'm kind of able, what I'm good at. And it was kind of quite an interesting sort of challenge to try and sort of open up those new spaces, in part because it's often difficult to get philosophers to care about things when you don't frame them in terms of these kinds of big questions. So yeah. One of the challenges I had with my thesis was that the kind of work that had been done in the philosophy of the historical sciences, paleontology and geology, a bit of archaeology, at that point had been either framed in terms of, you know, realism. So Derek Turner had done a lot of work that was sort of thinking about, should we be realists about historical science? You know, even if we are about, say, experimental science. And the other kind of framing, which came from Carol Cleland, was, historical science versus experimental science again. And, I was kind of interested in sort of framing things quite differently. And I think that was one of the hardest things sort of through the thesis and through the early parts of my career, was working out how to sort of situate the sorts of things I wanted to do such that they spoke to what philosophers were sort of interested in. Because I do sort of, you know, I think this is kind of, depending on what sort of philosophical space you hang out in, I think this is not as bad now, or maybe I've just gotten better at it and don't see it anymore. But yeah. Certainly, I sort of have this perception that often what happens is in order to legitimize what you're doing as a philosopher, you have to tie it to some big question, right? This is about the nature of explanation. This is about reduction. This is about realism. These big questions that philosophers of science cared a lot about in the 20th century. And I think that ultimately those questions became really constraining on the kinds of things we were able to do. And so, A lot of it was about sort of figuring out that actually there are ways that you can situate and frame things such that you can do what for me was more interesting work than having to sort of tie what I was doing to sort of realism or whatever.
Right. So there was still, so I imagine there was a little bit of framing in that, as you mentioned, things like realism and things like, so what did you, I guess, what did you end up doing in terms of, you know, did you end up like, for the purposes of just somewhat explaining, or I guess, how did you appropriate and convince people that, you know, your project is worth caring about?
Yeah. So the thesis, there's a couple of things to say here. So the thesis, turned into, like, if you had read my thesis and then you read my book, Rockburn and Ruin, you would find them hauntingly familiar. Not the same, but hauntingly familiar. So they kind of, one, the book's a downstream descendant of the thesis. And the MI approach was to just kind of have a different framing and sort of try and work that out. So the way I tried to do it was in terms of sort of what I called sort of pessimism and optimism, where these were really questions. I mean, when I read that stuff now, I can see I'm kind of reaching towards pursuit. That's really what I'm kind of going towards, but I haven't quite figured that out yet. And so I sort of say something like, instead of these questions about realism and anti-realism, which I think, you know, there are people who are doing really interesting work on those topics, but it takes a lot to sort of get them going, right? I was like, well, it seems like one question you might have is something like, should we think going into the future that these scientists are going to produce good knowledge, produce good stuff? And if so, how? What sorts of strategies are they adopting? And what can we normatively say about those strategies that make sense of what they're doing? And so the book is this kind of, and the thesis and was this.
Oh, these sciences, I just want to be clear. So things to geology, paleontology, archaeology, are there any other historical sciences you would include? Like, mainly those.
In terms of the list, I mean, there's obviously, my official philosophical position is there's nothing in itself interesting about what are often labeled the historical sciences. I don't think there's anything particularly special about it being historical. But generally what you might say, I would probably say sciences that are actively using traces, using some record, if you want, to kind of get a grip on their subject. So there are, you know, things that are clearly have historical bent to them. Something like evolutionary biology has this kind of historical kind of feeling to it, but they're not often really engaging with actual, you know, real careful sort of records of the past. They're rather thinking about current animals as in terms of sort of past things. So there's a sort of fuzzy boundaries there, but also absolutely stuff going on in various areas of sort of astronomy and cosmology.
Sure.
Like those kinds of sciences are, and there's some really fun work being done that's sort of thinking about the sorts of issues I think about, but in terms of let's call it physics-y stuff that I don't understand good. And also sort of human history as well, right? So there's a whole bunch of those issues. But my focus was very much on, like in the thesis, the two main case studies were one from paleobiology and one from sort of paleoclimatology. So sauropods and snowball Earth, basically.
Right. I'm seeing this here. Mm-hmm.
And both of those were... you know, the book was really, and the thesis was a sort of long sort of argument in favor of sort of optimism, where it was like, hey, actually, what these folks are really, really, really good at is coming up with these opportunistic, creative, often really messy strategies for doing lots of good stuff with really, really limited evidence. So they're working under sort of certain types of epistemic poverty. But they're so good at drawing things together and drawing things in and using all of these different strategies, in really sort of remarkable and apt ways that they really do produce way more than you would anticipate. And so that was kind of the sort of the argument through that set of work.
Was this in some ways responding to, I know you mentioned this is sort of new territory for a philosopher like yourself or someone just trying to think about these from a broader perspective, but was this responding in some way or looking at more of a position of pessimism regarding these sciences and that, you know, the way they're operating is like they're trying, but there's kind of a sense where the evidence that they're working from is not that great. It's pretty, I mean, it's literally in the past, but like way in the past, such that you have everything working against that. Maybe the consequence that should be I don't know, either that we should adjust the way we see these claims that they're making or their findings, or desire for different kinds of evidence, or not take them, you know, downgrade or see them as I don't know, the kinds of progress or knowledge that's being built in by these sciences should be qualified differently.
Yeah, so there's a lot of work to do, sort of finding foils in the right way. And I think this is something that is challenging when you're sort of doing philosophy in this mode, where often it's like, there's this thing that people kind of say, like kind of casually, this kind of attitude, and you can occasionally find someone outright saying it, but not that often. So certainly amongst scientists, including, you know, paleontologists and archaeologists themselves, but also particularly, you know, non-historical scientists, if you want, who sort of have these attitudes that are like, hey, that isn't really science. You can't do experiments, something like that. But Derek Turner's work was like incredibly important for me because he'd argued for the sort of anti-realist position, which involved him giving these pessimistic arguments, involved him sort of arguing that, hey, you know, you can't do experiments, that's bad, you don't have much evidence and that's bad. So he was crucial for me to be able to do that. And I think one of the ways in which I've kind of thought about at least a lot of my own work since then is that in some sense, I'm almost less interested in what it is I'm saying, and I'm more interested in the way in which that might open up sort of space where other people can then jump on and sort of start taking it into sort of different directions. So that was very much it. But I mean, in terms of there's another aspect to your question, which is like, how did I manage to get taken seriously? And a lot of that was some fairly conscious social engineering, basically. So myself and Joyce Havstad and Leonard Finkelman and Derek Turner started this blog called Extinct eight years ago or something. And we did that literally because there was a PSA in something like 2016 or something like this, where, you know, there was a few people who were doing this kind of thing. And we're like, well, maybe, you know, one of the problems is, you know, you say I do philosophy of paleontology and people are like, what on earth is that? Like,
right.
And the idea was to try and have a blog where we can make things kind of easy to read and get people used to the idea so that they're not just dismissing it out of hand, right? And so far as, I mean, it's very hard to actually tell what effect that had per se, but, you know, now there are quite a few people who are, you know, there's a large, quite a remarkable number of graduate students at the moment who are doing work. What's wonderful is that they're not necessarily really directly engaging with me per se, but what they are doing is, because part of the point is there's so much work to be done in these areas that just jump in, grab a case study and see what happens. And so it's really gratifying to me to now see that there are quite a few people and quite a few workshops and sort of things happening around the place where folks are really starting to think about these sciences. And incredibly difficult to tell like how the influence actually went, but I sort of had this sort of sense in which by putting it out there in that way meant that when my papers went to journals or when referees got them or when I put things into conferences, people weren't just going, well, that's weird. They were like, oh yeah, I vaguely know that people are working on this, so I'm going to take it seriously. And so we ran that for sort of 4 years or so, and it's been kind of defunct for a while. We might be starting it up again soon, so, you know, watch the space. There was some sort of quite conscious, and also doing things like, oh well, have a sort of special issue here and there and try and create spaces where people can come in and start working on this stuff.
Right. No, I think, I mean, I don't think I've read the blog, but I definitely have. I think I've heard of it. I've heard, at least heard it, seen it covered and by maybe some other philosopher magazines. I think just for creating that space for people to come together is really, just as we see the I wouldn't even call this hyper-specialization. This is not, I wouldn't say this is an example of it, but just an example just a focus on a collection of grouping of sciences, right? Like, I mean, you're seeing, if you look at the PSA coming up this year, I mean, you see so many different special working groups. But this, I don't know, this, I mean, this is like a, I don't even know how to map or name these parts that you would describe. I mean, I think the historical sciences is, I know you said there's nothing maybe, you know, there's no real content necessarily there, make it somewhat distinct per se, but it's nice to have something because there are certain questions that revolve around those sciences that people can talk about together.
Yeah. So it turns out that like labels are kind of important. I mean, one of the awkward things about it is that there are a lot of people who are doing this stuff now are kind of interested in like what they'll often call geosciences. So these are sort of geology, and geology is not always historical, right? A lot of the time it's looking at current processes and things like that. And there's huge amounts of sort of overlap between those discussions, but it makes it awkward to call it historical science if someone's rocking up and
right, we have to be careful about
something
that.
Historical. But that's a part of the game. But it's definitely true. I mean, one of the things, like talking about specialization in the philosophy of science, like just look at the landscape of the PSA. It's so different now than it was 10, 15 years ago, right? So
that's
now
fascinating. Yeah.
Like it's so much more diverse, and you know, I think that this is like. Very, very good.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's interesting to hear. I think there are certain folks like yourself who come from a seeing this as a very good thing. I think some of those, the old guard, are a little bit, I think they appreciate all the different projects and things, but, you know, the folks who would, you know, introduce themselves at a thinking, you know, saying, oh, I work on causation or something like that. Like it's, different perceptions, but yeah, no, I'm fascinated by this this rise and this work. So what we kind of jumped ahead a little bit, but yeah, so your dissertation on the historical sciences, getting people together, so this happened, the book, which the dissertation which came, the book came out in 2018, but during this time you're studying, you're complete finishing from Australia. What happened next in the career trajectory?
I had to finish the thesis fairly quickly because I was sort of lucky enough to get a postdoc in Calgary. I worked with Mark Hershefsky and various other folks in Calgary for a couple of years. And that was really wonderful.
Yeah, they have a great program out there.
Yeah, they do. And it was also really nice sort of, you know, the sort of dream sort of postdoc where it's just like, just do what you want for a few years.
That's great.
You know, and that was really, really important because it sort of gave me space to kind of just start sort of getting stuff out there and thinking about things and really making, because the book took a long time to come out, right? The book got... You know, rejected from a publisher, and then you know. So,
interesting.
It took a long time. It was a painful process. Like MIT were absolutely brilliant. I had a wonderful experience with them.
Wonderful,
rejected on an R&R, which with a book is a nightmare. It was crushing.
I'm so sorry. Oh wow.
And so by the time it came out in 2018, it was written in 2016, 2015 or something.
Gotcha. Like this, gotcha.
So by the time it came out, I was, and everyone who has a book will say this, right? Like by the time the things come out, you've moved beyond it.
Right.
Okay.
No, well, I've heard very good things about MIT Press, especially they're just very friendly with philosophers of science. And so, but yeah.
They also, had, I have to say, an amazing copy editor. Like you know, it was, they went through and they made my prose more readable and less idiosyncratic, but also still in my voice. And it was like, it's the nicest thing I've written in terms of reading it. Like everything else feels like really mucky compared to that book. It's really,
like you read this, you're like, wow, I sound great. This is amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
This is like I'm really happy to hear that. And so, yeah, so getting to do this great postdoc, I imagine. So it sounds like working on the book, other things, developing the career at the time. Then it looks like you were able to secure a postdoc at Cambridge for a little bit.
So that was this wild handbrake turn where roughly, so there's a center in Cambridge called the Center for the Study of Existential Risk. Where existential risk is basically, the way I like thinking about it is like a risk to the existence of something. So it's not about the probability of it happening or the damage of it happening or something like that. It's like, no, this thing might stop being there, which is usually focused on kind of human level extinction, right? Events kind of thing. And the reason I was brought on, you might think it's very strange that I was brought onto this project. But what I was coming in to talk about was the sort of social structure of science. The idea being that, you know, if you want to, so these folks are, you know, very into, you know, the thought's kind of clear, like, look, you know, add sort of technological, you know, runaway technological increases, add the fact that we're more aware of there being these like, very low probability, but really bad high impact events that could sort of happen. It seems like this is something that we should be studying very, very hard. But also it's actually quite difficult to study those things using the normal standards of science, right? So if you're standardly trying to do science, you want to do statistics, you want to do these kinds of things. And it's very hard to have that kind of access to these sorts of events. And to my sort of way in was sort of by going, well, actually, there are a lot of similarities in a strange way between the kinds of constraints that you have when you're being a paleontologist and the kind of constraints you might have when you're trying to work out, you know, these sort of future events. And there are also ways in which the social structure of science can make that really, really difficult. And so that project was really about thinking about the role of creativity and speculation in science and how it is that scientific communities might be made more amenable to that kind of thing. And so that was kind of this very strange for me sort of sidestep where I started sort of thinking about this completely different range of issues, which was incredibly fun. I also must say it's difficult because, you know, I mentioned the great thing about the postdoc in Calgary was it was, you know, on one end of the postdoc scale, which is do what you want. This mm-hmm. was a much more sort of, you know, this postdoc were things I wanted to do that they wanted me to do. And right. I was able to do them. But, you know, I think many people who become philosophers are kind of a bit selfish, and I'm a bit selfish.
Sure.
It was kind of tricky to really motivate myself to do some of that work, but I'm incredibly glad I did, right? It was really, really interesting to sort of spend time in those very, very different kind of academic spaces. Yeah. And so that got me into, you know, thinking about sort of risk and, but mostly the sort of social structure of science.
Great. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit about then, you know, the focus on thinking about the existential risk, but then so what kinds of claims or what kinds of things were you defending in terms of creativity across the sciences?
So one way of thinking about it is, think about the sort of incentive structures that kind of scientists face. And scientists, a bit like philosophers, most academics, right? And here I'm thinking about academic science rather than science or et cetera. You're in a situation where there are various sort of forces which are leading towards conservatism, right? Where I mean conservative about the kind of work you do. Just want to check that you're still here. Yep, you're still here.
Oh, yeah. Hold on a second. Oh, yeah. So, Keep talking. Our internet is coming in.
One it's second. Fighting. Yeah.
It's I'm gonna. Oh, come on. Okay. Come on. Here we go. Sorry, one moment. Oh, talk about technical difficulties. How are we? Okay, we're back. We're back. We're back. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So think about it this way. Think about you have the sort of set of incentives and the kind of institutional structures you get into when you're a scientist, right? First off, you're doing your degree. You're in a lab. You're being taught, you know, very standard Kuhnian normal science kinds of things, right? You're being taught how to do science in a particular way. What does a good question look like? What does a good answer look like? That's constraining you in certain ways. And then when you get into the world of sort of publishing and getting grants, then you've got things like, you know, your peers who have gone through a similar training process as you are also judging and gatekeeping what sorts of things get to be done and how. And so scientists get really funneled into these sort of particular areas. Now, of course, there are some who are able to then suddenly do this crazy thing and create a new bandwagon that people jump on. But that itself is kind of an effect of that sort of incentive structure where things get led funneled in various ways. And there's something good about that, right? Because it means that folks can work on similar issues and things can accumulate, right? It's not a wholly negative process. We shouldn't feel completely negative about those structures. But particularly if you're interested in, you know, people doing serious scientific work on areas that are really tricky and messy, suddenly it just is a huge risk, right? You're not, you have to eat, you have to get a postdoc, you have to, yeah. You know, it's really difficult to do sort of, you know, more radical work within the structure of academic science. And so that was sort of the basic sort of setup of the problem. In terms of what should be done,
right.
That's really hard. I didn't get too far beyond the here's the problem.
Sort at of least you reduced the problem into a more complicated problem, and then or clarified and named some parts and things like that. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I also think the solutions, in a sense, are often sort of practical things about like
sure.
increased diversity in modes of publishing, having sort of grants that are policed and in different ways, right? So. There's much more work on this now than there was, say, a decade ago. There's, you know, people are really thinking about alternative modes of publishing and alternative modes of refereeing things and things like that. And I think that having a more diverse sort of publishing and grant landscape could potentially do a lot of work towards having a much more diverse kind of scientific landscape.
Very good. Very good. So interesting getting, so I see, I mean, it's good to see you've done quite a, I mean, managed to like get some very, I would say like very successful and strong postdoctoral positions where you were able to really develop your own work on other projects. But, so this has led you to, since it looks like, 2009, working as a senior lecturer, at the Department of Exeter in this, kind of a hybrid, sociology, anthropology, and philosophy department. So how was, we kind of started the interview discussing things going on there, but yeah, what is your time been like there? What is, obviously, you know, during the pandemic, it's probably shaped your time considerably in terms of
sure.
like what it's like, but at least, you know, what has it been like, going from these, from very prestigious postdocs to, right. you know, fitting into the more formal role now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's worth saying that, there's this annoying thing with the relationship between postdocs and entry-level permanent jobs where, the postdocs, you have a lot of time to do stuff, but right. also you're living wildly precariously. And I was incredibly lucky. So I, you know, managed to have a good 5 years or so where I was on postdocs. There wasn't a point where I didn't have a job. Right. But also, you know, my partner, Kirsten Walsh, is also a philosopher of science. And she, there was a bit where, yeah, so she had a postdoc in Bucharest and I had a postdoc in Calgary for a while, which was ridiculous.
Oh, that's tough.
And
yeah.
When I was in Cambridge, she was in Nottingham, blah, blah, blah. And so one thing, we were just so lucky where we kind of solved the two body problem. You know, Exeter had three jobs and we managed to get two of them. And so although there is this sort of,
wow.
yeah. You very quickly, you know, I remember when I was a postdoc sort of being annoyed by the sort of kvetching that the, the people with permanent jobs would have about all this admin they have to do. I now do that all. I now complain about that.
Really, I'm very guilty of that. It's work. It is work, you know, and that's okay. Yeah. That's, I understand. I mean, it's.
And I think it's also something that's worth sort of speaking to. Like, there's this thing where folks who are in precarious situations, again, I was, you know, it was horrible for me and I was so lucky. So, you know, terrible for other people who are right. even more precarious, is that like when you go into a sort of permanent job, a whole range of different challenges kind of come in. It becomes a lot more about protecting your research time and working out how to navigate these like kind of Kafkian systems that universities have kind of built for us. And so it's a very, so you sort of, there is a real gear shift that sort of happens. I do think for me that like, it took me a long time to get over the job market and all that. It took me, you know, a good
right,
few years
right.
for me to feel kind of okay again, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, I imagine even those times during postdoc, it's probably actively searching or think, or like at least toward those ender, maybe throughout the whole time. And it's a lot of, a lot of pain, a lot of frustration, all the while. Yeah. So,
but yeah, it's brutal. And so, yeah. And again, sort of course, it's very hard to, really ascertain how things have been at Exeter, in part because you see the pandemic, but also in Britain, you know, we've been striking right. on and off for the last, since I started.
Even before. And yeah.
So, yeah. And so things are, I continue to be sort of optimistic about the future. But certainly in terms of the research environment, at Exeter, like in a genus, it's such a, rich and open, kind of place for doing really, really, you know, you get sort of such a wide variety of, different people doing different kinds of things, which if you're someone like me who I'm what's the way of putting it? I have a very short attention span, and it's really useful to me to have people throwing different things at me. And so for me, it's really, really wonderful. Also having sort of a very active kind of, you know, visitor program. So we've got people coming through quite often and those sorts of things. So it is an incredibly wonderful place to be during an incredibly hard time, I think is the way to put it.
Wonderful. All right. Well, tell us a little bit about, before we get to sort of our end question, tell us a little bit about, your current projects, your current focus, if there's any recent work that has come out of that you're excited.
Checking if you're still here.
I'm still here.
There's probably maybe sort of two things that have happened. So that I'm working on at the moment. One is a sort of continuation of the let's think about our knowledge of the past kind of project.
Right.
Where this is sort of the short version of this is something like the way that people think about a knowledge of the past. So if I was to ask you sort of, you know, what's hard about knowing about the past? People will start saying things like, oh, well, we don't have, we were doing this earlier in the conversation. There isn't much evidence. The records are gappy, right? There isn't,
right.
That sort of stuff. And, again, mentioning Derek again. So Derek Turner's 2019 book, Paleoesthetics, has this really nice discussion of that's a metaphor. That's a textual metaphor. We're thinking about, the archaeological, paleontological, geological record. As if it were like a record, as if it were like a set of registries that people had written down. And that, as Derek points out, that leads us to sort of think about a knowledge of the past in particular ways, right? And so I'm interested in sort of trying to figure out other kinds of ways we might conceive of this sort of project. And the thing that I'm kind of thinking about at the moment is one thing that's odd about going to, say, a vertebrate paleontology conference is there'll be sessions just on living birds. Mm-hmm. They'll just be talking about, here's some stuff about birds. And you might think that's weird. If what they're in the business of doing is trying to decode these records, why do they care so much about birds? And what's going on, of course, is that these things are related to dinosaurs and these things are related to extinct birds. They're, if you want, analogies. And one of the big difficulties if you're trying to find out about, say, a dinosaur is that there are no analogies, right? You've got birds and crocodiles, the most closely related living things to them, but birds and crocodiles aren't enormous quadrupedal herd animals, right? You've got large quadrupedal herd animals, but those are mammals. They're like wildly different types of animals. And so there's this kind of question, which is like, well, how do you find out about the past when the past is really alien, when the past is governed by dynamics or filled with entities that are profoundly different from the entities that we see around us? Because when you're finding out about the past, you don't just have to care about what information has been retained. You also have to care about what kinds of regularities you can find, right? So one way of thinking about it is sort of uniformitarianism, right? So when you get cases where the past is just different from the present, what do you do? How do scientists deal with those circumstances? And so I think this is this kind of, you know, a really interesting and deep challenge that historical scientists kind of overcome all the time. But it's not something that comes out when you start the discussion by saying, hey, we're dealing with a gappy record.
Right.
So the project, it's sort of the sort of evocative label is kind of lost worlds. So there's this idea that what happens when you're finding out about the world, a past world that just doesn't contain the same things as your own world. Another way of putting it is one of our constraints on the knowledge of the past isn't just what traces have remained, the ways that the record is gappy. It's also what still exists. Right. So
literally what?
Yeah. And so that's sort of that big project. The other thing, which is much more collaborative, which is, you know, I quite like sort of falling into doing work is, work on the sort of aesthetics of science. So, this is sort of, I think, a really interesting sort of challenging project because on the one hand, when people have done the aesthetics of science, they've more or less been interested in particular aesthetics-y concepts as applied to theories, right?
So, gotcha.
Is it, you know, are simple or more elegant theories sort of better or something like that? And that isn't, you know, that's a fine discussion to have, but I find the aesthetics tends to fall out. Whereas So the sort of project, so working with, so Elena Ivanova, for instance, has been doing really nice work on the sort of aesthetics of experiments. So what makes for, how does aesthetic practice play into experiments? I mentioned Derek Turner's book, Paleoaesthetics, where that sort of thinking about how aesthetic values play into what paleontologists do. Caitlin Wiley, who's an anthropologist of science, has really interesting work on the way that aesthetics plays into fossil preparation. And so I'm kind of interested in thinking about taking seriously the role that aesthetic value might play in scientific practice and trying to sort of get an analysis of that. And one thing that I think is kind of hopefully exciting about this project is that, of course, we all care about sort of science and values at the moment. You know, this is a big deal. But often this range of values we're interested in are something like sort of moral and prudential values, particularly sort of moral values.
Right.
And I think there's a much richer sort of conversation to be had. It's just a tricky one to work out exactly how to have it, but hope we're getting there.
Great. Well, no, thank you. No, that sounds like a very fascinating project, and I'll have to look up some of Milena. Oh, yeah, she has a book written out. Yeah, okay. Well, thank you for sharing a little bit about your project. So it sounds very, very fascinating or exciting. Let's conclude by addressing the last question that I asked folks, which is, what do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
Yeah, I mean, I have to go with the sort of unphilosophically rich sort of social thing, right? It's, you know, we're not really living, many of us are not really living in environments that are conducive to philosophers of science doing sort of good and interesting work. I think, you know, the material conditions of doing the philosophy of science are increasingly challenged, and you know, so the problems, if you want, are kind of social and political.
No, please. This is fine.
And these are problems, and these are problems which, you know, are in no way unique to philosophy of science, nor unique to philosophy. So the increasing kind of commodification, the increasing sort of managerial, aspect of grants, of university structures, the increasing, stress on, our work being pointed in certain directions, I think is an enormous challenge, right? And, you know, it might just turn out that, it becomes increasingly rare to be able to spend 5 or 6 years just kind of thinking about dinosaurs, you know, and I think that that would be, you know, really sad. I think that, it's incredibly important to be able to have people, like, for the same reason that I think that scientists should be able to do a bunch of weird stuff, I think that other academics ought to as well. And so I really, you know, like, I think that, from my perspective, holding that fixed, the philosophy of science is really, really thriving at the moment. So I know, you know, you think about the enormous diversification in methods these days, right? So you have folks doing agent-based modeling, you have folks running simulations, you have folks starting to incorporate, digital humanities techniques, you've got people, you know, doing sort of experiments. It's much people really engaging with sort of the anthropology and sociology of science. And I think that that is just, you know, the diversification from my perspective is kind of wonderful and great, right? So I kind of think that that is, you know, like, I think the philosophy of science is actually, this is the best time in that respect to be doing the philosophy of science. I think your options are so much more open than they at least felt 10 years ago. But there's so much squeeze from outside. So I'm optimistic internally.
Internally, but the ideas are there, and sometimes there can be support for them, but by material conditions, you just mean essentially like the access to like, to living, essentially, to be able to focus your time and efforts into doing this work, and be incentivized to do so. The incentive structures are not great, and they're limited, definitely. I've been thinking about this problem quite a lot and wondering, I know other academics face this as well, how and in what ways this could be resolved is, it's very challenging to say.
I mean, I think a lot of it is, to do with, you know, there's much broader stuff that as individuals we have some only limited control over. A lot of it is about things like government policy. And, you know, we can, you know, try and do something about that. But I do also think there are local things, more local things you can do. So there are sort of philosophy societies, there are sort of groups that you can sort of support or at least sort of influence in some way towards, you know, supporting people more so, right? I'm not brilliant at doing this, but I try.
Sure.
And so I do think that, you know, there are local things, particularly, I mean, as you get more fancy, right? So, you know, the more powerful you are, the more you can do. But I do think that at the very least, being aware of these issues and thinking about how they constrain things is important.
Good.
Yeah, we're about to run out of time, I see.
Yeah, we're gonna use this clock to end. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, Adrian. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. Good luck with these two new projects, and yeah, hope to see you around at a conference soon. Are you coming to the PSA?
I am. I will be at the PSA.
Okay. Yeah. I'll come and say hello. But anyway,
great to see
take
you.
Care. Thanks. Have a good rest of the day. Right. Bye-bye.
See ya.